Hi, today's October 14th, 2018. I'm Todd Agassi-Orr, my good friend John Westfall, and we have our special guest panelist and old friend, Frank McPherson, on with us. And I think for a good chunk of this podcast, we're going to be solely focused on Google's hardware announcements this past week. Something else may crop along, but they crop up, but they sure announced a lot of stuff. So I should, you know, amongst all the stuff that was announced, I think the only thing I'm pretty sure I'm going to buy are the $30 Google Pixel USB-C earbuds, because the rest of the stuff is pretty expensive. But we'll get around to polling you guys to see if you guys are going to buy anything, especially you, John, since you've been on the fence on buying something Google-ish. So anyway, the reason the Google Pixel USB-C earbuds are interesting is because A, they're $30, but B, they apparently have all the functionality of the $150 Bluetooth Google Pixel earbuds, that were released last year. And, you know, most of it is kind of marketing trickery, but, you know, the idea is that with the earbuds, you can automatically activate Google Translate and have it do near real-time translation as you speak to someone and someone speaks to you. I don't really have a huge need for that, but it's kind of a neat idea, and I would like to have another pair of USB-C earbuds. And $30 is a pretty good price. So, John, I know you don't have any... Well, I don't know if you have any USB-C gear, but...
Yeah, I'm still USB-C-less.
Yeah.
So, but I do like the idea of a nice headset with a little bit of fun stuff packed in, like these have.
How about you, Frank?
So, the moment that they were available on the store, I put in my order, and I got them yesterday.
I didn't even order mine yet.
I have in my hand the said headset that we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
To be honest, I bought it primarily because I did not have a USB-C headset. So, not that I use an awful lot, but since I have a Pixel 2 with only a USB-C port, and USB-C seems to be the thing, it seemed like a worthwhile thing to invest some money on. So
I haven't played around
a ton with them. It works as expected with Google Assistant. Obviously, the audio sounds fine. You got these little loop things to adjust the sizing in the ear, which is, I guess, okay. It's just basically using part of the cord from the two parts that go in your ear.
Yeah.
I haven't tried to translate stuff. I don't have much opportunity to talk with people who are not English speaking, so I haven't really done that too much.
So I was going to ask, didn't your my Pixel 2 came with earbuds?
My Pixel 2 came with a dongle.
Oh.
That I could use a regular 3.5 millimeter headset with.
Yeah.
Which I have them. That works. That's fine.
Yeah.
Dongles get lost.
Yep.
So now I have two, right? I have that still, and then I have this. So I guess that covers me, plus a Bluetooth headset if I were to choose to use that.
Okay. I guess in order to keep up with Frank, I got to go order mine as soon as the podcast is done.
But you're right.
Order it right now.
And you're right in your point that it was the one thing they announced that was, less than $100.
Yeah.
So.
It was the only affordable thing that I can remember announced.
I don't know how much we'll talk about the new Google Hub.
Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that.
But that's $150, so yeah. that's reasonable.
That's not too bad. That's not too bad, yeah. And if I didn't already have the Lenovo Smart Display, I would certainly consider it. But we can talk about why it's not the same thing as we go on. So the other thing is the Google Pixel 3. So, John, are you going to order one?
Well, so we talked last week and the week before about how I definitely do have a desire to play with a modern Android smartphone.
Right.
But I've been very tempted by this idea of having an always-connected iPad.
Yeah.
And since people do say that apparently having the cellular version of the iPad changes your life, I'm not sure about that, but I do use my iPad at least 3 or 4 hours a day, so I am still on the fence. It kind of depends on what Apple announces when they next refresh iPads.
If which may be this month.
Yeah, if they announce something that makes me go, you know what? I think I'll limp along on my iPad Pro 10.5 for another year or two. Then the Pixel looks attractive again. If they announce something where I go, might want to upgrade for that and get cellular, then I might go that direction. But I do like the Pixel 3. I've taken a look at it, and definitely some of the flashy features we'll talk about. I think it's a solid evolution of Pixel 2, but I haven't quite jumped on in to get it yet.
And what about you, Frank? You've already got a Pixel 2. Are you going to stay with it, or are you going to upgrade?
Oh, I will stay with my Pixel 2. I just bought it a year ago, so there's really no reason for me to swap that out with the newer phone. This one works perfectly for me. It's the same size as the Pixel as far as the physical dimensions are concerned. The Pixel 3 does have a larger screen because they've now decreased the bezels and increased the screen size, but I'm told the physical size is still the same, which is good. My biggest reaction is the price. I mean, it's a $150 price increase for the sake of that larger screen primarily. And the fact that you have now the glass back to support wireless charging.
Yeah, it's like, what, $900 or something or more?
Yeah, it's I think it's about $799.
Okay.
Or is it $800?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's, maybe the XL is the one that starts at $900, but it's premium pricing.
$799. $899 for the XL.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm the same, by the way. I've got a Pixel 2 also, and I have no intention to upgrade to the 3. It's just way too expensive. And I haven't paid off my, you know, I'm doing the no interest monthly payment through Google Fi for my Pixel 2. So I'm only halfway through my payment cycle. So no Pixel 3 for me.
Now, the interesting thing I've noticed so far is that the Pixel 2 is still listed on the Google Store for sale.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful. One of my gripes with Google and their, you know, march towards the premium market following along with Apple and Samsung and the other vendors is that they have not been continuing to sell their older model products. I mean, basically, you go to Apple today, if you don't like the price of the newest iPhones, you have options, and you can still get an iPhone that's getting, you know, the latest and greatest versions of iOS. Android, up to this point, has only been selling one model, a Pixel. And now they have the Pixel 2 that's still out there. And, you know, if they follow Apple's footsteps of keeping that out there and maybe lowering the price and making a commitment to continue Android support for the older model Pixels for, you know, more than 2 years, then things might, you know, there might be a working solution there. But, you know, it is definitely frustrating. I had to upgrade out of my Nexus 6P because, frankly, they dropped support for it for Android after only 2 years. And that's not good.
Yeah, I was in the same boat with my Nexus 6, you know, 1 year before yours. And I bought it mid-cycle. I bought it in, you know, after it was already 1 year old. So basically, I got a year and a half of updates. And then I was dead in the water. Unlike an iPhone where, you know, you'll get 4 years of updates maybe. You can buy a phone today and it'll be good in 2021. As far as upgrades go, you know, the 10S that I bought today, I fully expect to get an upgrade for it, for iOS upgrade for it in 2021. The Pixel 2 I bought last year, I'd be surprised. I think they committed to 3 years of updates for this one, but even that falls short of what Apple provides to their customers. So, yeah, and also leads to fragmentation.
I think that Google sort of forgot when they made the transition from Nexus to Pixel. Nexus, that was a project that was ostensibly good hardware so that developers knew what they could do with the platform. And then all of a sudden regular users start buying it because it was better hardware than what the other Android manufacturers were doing. So now that they have a brand, that the whole design of the brand is you're going to use this brand, you're going to buy this brand, they need to sort of start doing the things that we otherwise expect out of the brands like Apple, where longer-term support, more options price-wise, not just one model. So it's almost like they're still in Nexus world and haven't transitioned to Pixel world.
Yeah, and you know, the original Nexus, which I bought, and I think Frank also bought.
I bought too.
And it was, I think it was $200 list, unsubsidized.
It was pretty cheap. It was, but it was a good phone.
It was
and
a good
it
phone.
Ran stock Android.
And it didn't have those awful, you know, aftermarket UIs that various manufacturers put on their phones to distinguish themselves, which is one of the reasons I liked it. But it also only got, I think, a year and a half of updates. So, you know, it's a highly fragmented device. And quite frankly, it was kind of useless at the year, too, because it had so little system memory and storage that nothing could be updated at one point. I literally ran out of, after I deleted all third-party apps, I couldn't even update the Google apps.
Yeah, there was constraints with some of the memory and storage space, but that's no longer really an issue. I mean, frankly, there is no reason why my Nexus 6P could not be upgraded to Android 6, to Android 9. I mean, there's no technical limitation for it. It's just purely a fact that Google did not want to continue supporting that device. And, you know, that's not good. And I put a premium, John kind of mentioned it, about stock Android. I mean, at the end of the day, for me, I mean, the pricing is a factor. And that was an attraction to the Nexus devices. But stock Android was really a premium for me, particularly from a history of Windows Mobile and the pains we went through with the OEM dependencies. You know, I try to not repeat that. And so today, if you really want stock Android, you got to go with either a Pixel or you go with the other option that's not very well known is Android One.
Yeah.
Which is originally was part of the lower, you know, some of the other countries in lower, it was a little more cost sensitive. But I think there's one phone, if I'm looking out here, the Nokia 7.1, which I don't think is released yet, is supposed to be an Android One phone that will be available in the U.S. market. And as I understand it, Android One is, again, assured of having like a stock version of Android with it. So I think that was targeted at kind of the mid-range to low-end price market for Android, but it hasn't been something they've targeted in the United States. The one it is targeted, the Nokia 7.1, is yet to be sold.
Yeah, I think this week in Google, Kevin Toefel mentioned that he bought the European version of the Nokia 7 or 7.1 and likes it a lot. That's his daily driver. So, you know, it lacks some of the frequency, so I'm not sure what kind of coverage he's getting, but...
And I would look at the OnePlus 6, the 6T.
Yeah.
But there now you're not dealing with stock Android. You're dealing with a tailored version of Android. I think they call it Oxygen, right? Their version for of Android on that device. So now you're constrained to that particular hardware vendor's release of the updates and when they get around to it and everything else. So some of this makes you kind of, you know, there's advantages to iPhone. I mean, I would confess it for the first time, given this announcement. I've kind of asked myself, maybe I should switch to iPhone being assured of getting the operating system update straight from the vendor is that important to me.
Yeah, and for me, well, that's one of the many reasons I went from, you know, kind of a non-Google brand to the original Nexus is because I had a Motorola Droid. Which I call the first successful Android phone. You know, I know both of you had the G1s, and I know, Frank, you especially liked your G1, but I was not enamored at all with some of the early Android phones. I returned my G1 because my battery kept dying by lunchtime. You had that giant battery pack, as I recall.
Yeah, well, I've been with Android since that first device.
Yeah.
Just about every phone that I've owned has been either a made by Google phone or a Nexus phone. The G1 was not considered a Nexus, so that was, I think, one of the first kind of Google branded phones.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've made a commitment to Android and to Google either through the Nexus brand or the Pixel brand, but the pricing that they're kind of heading towards or have now is really got me kind of wondering whether I want to stick to it or not.
I know the $1,000 price point. I mean, you know, that's not to say that iPhones are cheap. I mean, certainly I just paid over $1,000 for a 10S, but like I said, I know it's going to get updates for more than 2 years, or I shouldn't say I know that. I assume it'll get updates.
Yeah, you will probably get, I mean, there's no reason to expect Apple to do anything different. And right now, you can get iOS 12 on like an iPhone 5. So, I mean, there you've made an investment on a device that's going to last you probably at least 4 years comfortably, yeah. and will probably work very well 3 to 4 years from now, given the hardware specs and Apple's history of really optimizing iOS for all their devices. Yeah.
That said, you know, I use my Nexus 6 as kind of a tiny tablet around the house. You know, it doesn't have carrier anymore. Since I switched to my Pixel 2, but it works fine as Android device. It doesn't have that, you know, that aging sluggishness that some of my older Android devices had after they retired. So it's also not getting any updates and hasn't had an update in, gosh, over a year now, which is why I bought a Pixel 2. But anyway, so one of the things I'm really looking forward to, even though I'm not getting a Pixel 3, is a feature that they announced with the 3, which is called Google Call Screen. And it's supposed to come down to the Pixel 2 that you and I use, you know, at some point in time. I intend to use the heck out of that thing.
Well, I had a question about that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the main reason for it is because of all the telemarketing calls that we get today, right?
Yeah.
And I was under the impression that one of the worst things you could do was to actually answer the call.
Well, you know, you have a point
there. When I get a call, I just ignore it. And so call screening actually answers the call. You're giving the signal to the telemarketers
that you're there.
That's a valid phone number. And, you know, if it acknowledges that you're, you know, it's you, you got a screener for Frank McPherson, you're kind of giving them information you didn't want to give them. So I'm a little, plus I think with the call screening still, you know, it gives you the opportunity to monitor things, but you're still being disrupted in that process. So I am a little unsure of the benefit of that call screening feature.
Well, right now, and I'm going to put we're audio only, but I'm showing Frank and John what my incoming call list looks like. And most of it is marked spam. And I think the spam calls don't actually ring my phone, if I recall correctly, the way I have it configured. So at least either spam I've pre-identified or spam that's identified by Google Fi shouldn't ring my phone, I think, or doesn't ring my phone.
And that's how I have mine configured now, too, is that it doesn't ring, but it goes to voicemail.
It does.
And now I'm getting voicemail notifications after I get all get those calls.
Yeah, that's true.
It still leaves a message. So it still can be a slight disruption.
Right. And somebody's still answering the phone, so they know it's a valid number. Yeah. But, I'm going to try it out, see what it's like. And I'm looking forward. And sometimes, you know, I do get calls from actual people. It's fairly rare, to be honest. but you know, if it's unknown or I just can't get the phone, I'm planning to use it. And for folks who didn't watch the announcement, so what call screening is it's an AI system that will answer the phone, say that it's an AI of some sort, and basically has a conversation with the caller saying, you know, what is it you'd like to ask or what is it you'd like to say, and I think it even does follow-up questions. So
I think this is basically an implementation of something they showed at Google I/O called, I believe, Duplex.
Yes, you're right.
Which was the demo they did with the AI bot that called a restaurant and made a reservation for a person.
Right.
And the person on the other end of the phone couldn't even tell that it was not a human. And there was a bit of an uproar about that because it wasn't, you know, saying ahead of time that it was a bot.
Right.
So this, I think, is an implementation of that. And as you noted, it does inform the person it's interacting with that it's a bot reporting on your behalf. But it is probably a more or less creepy implementation of that technology. So it probably makes sense in that regard.
And I found Duplex fascinating, even though it horrified some people, because it even had human-like tics, like saying and other speech interstitials that many of us have, those of us who are not professional speakers of any sort. So I thought it was pretty cool, but other people, like you said, were creeped out. I'm looking forward to this, because, like I said, the vast majority of my calls are not people, and the call screening is working. The spam screening seems to be working. I find some of the recorded messages interesting, by the way. And John and I have had this talk about the the Chinese embassy scam, where, you know, the caller is speaking in Mandarin. If you don't speak in Mandarin, which I don't, it doesn't mean a lot. But, you know, my phone did capture it, and I put it to a translator. And then later I saw an NPR article about this scam, which is fascinating. It's basically threatening you to send money, to get some paperwork. Otherwise, you know, the Chinese embassy or Chinese consulate is going to send some kind of people to arrest you. And anyway, it's quite bad. But, you know, for those of us who are not threatened in any way with this sort of thing, it's got its amusing points, especially since it's in Hawaii. We've got a, you know, large Asian population, large Chinese population. So we're being geographically targeted for these things.
My recommendation to avoid spam calls is have a phone number with an area code outside of where you live. Because the added benefit I've found to that is that when I get calls from my home area code, it's a number I don't recognize, like my home from where I used to live, it's never a legitimate call. It's always a robo-dialer because they're just targeting whole blocks of area code. And they're spoofing from that same area code. So that's been kind of a very unexpected, foolproof way for me. And if I actually get a call from the area code that I'm currently living in, 99% of the time, it's a legit call.
Oh, not me.
Because, it's bizarre. I didn't realize that would happen, but all you have to do is just keep the same phone number as you move from five or six different states, and you have that sort of weird geographical benefit.
Well, I don't think Frank's moved five different states.
No, the only but I do get, I mean, the majority of the telemarketing calls I get are my local area.
I was going to say the same thing.
And so basically right now, if I get a phone call and it doesn't come up on caller ID, meaning the either AT&T is my provider or it doesn't match my contacts, I don't even bother to answer the call. I just decline it. And if it, you know, I'm under the adage, if it is important, somebody will leave a voicemail message and I'll return the call. Or, you know, they'll call my home number or something. But, you're getting to the point, basically, I don't know, you'd like to think there would be some regulation or something. But you're basically now where all you need, really want, is an ability to call out. In case, you know, so you can make a phone call but not receive anything. And primarily use the device for data.
Right.
You know? So, you know,
Which is how most of us use it.
Phone service is basically just being ruined, just like email to a large extent has been
just
ruined.
Spam. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I was going to say that I not only are the vast majority of my spam calls local, I know what prefixes they are. They're mostly T-Mobile prefixes for my area code. And also one that's most of us never think of is Level 3, which got bought by somebody or other. I can't even remember who owns them now. But Level 3 has a set of a small number of prefixes in our state. They're not one of the major, you know, carriers of anything, but they usually start with 1, like 1-9. And I'd like to just block all of Level 3 because I don't know anybody would call me from a Level 3 number to begin with. Most of those, I think Level 3 mostly services things like hotels and things like that, where they provide actual local phone service. I see that pattern all the time. In fact, if you look at my spam calls with my local area code 808, you can kind of, I'm just kind of looking in now. It's a whole bunch of 38X numbers, which is T-Mobile. And a bunch of 1-8 and 1-9s, which 1-9X, 1-8X, which is Level 3. And then there's, you know, a couple coming from outside of the state from various and sundry calls. I'm kind of scrolling down, and out of about 20 or 30 incoming calls, I think one is from actual human being. Oh, two. That's because my sister called me by accident. Apologize. But okay, Pixel 3, okay, then, wow, we're already in 25-minute mark. Next item was the one I was the most interested in and was really tempted, or it's not actually for sale yet, but was really tempted to buy, and then I thought some more, but I'll ask you guys what you think. That's the Google Pixel Slate, which is not Android-based, it's Chrome OS-based. It is a tablet, hence its name, Slate. It has a physical connector for keyboard, like the iPad Pro, And has a optional pen. Now, this is the part that made me say no. So originally, when I heard about this, I think what I told John a week or two ago was, if this thing comes in under $700, I would probably buy it. But I should have qualified that. If this thing came in under $700, completely configured, I would buy it. But unfortunately, the lowest end device, and there's like a whole bunch of, I don't know, I think there's like six models or something. The lowest end model is $600. That's with a Celeron processor and 32 gigs of storage or something. The keyboard is $200, which is amazing to me. I mean, even the iPad Pro keyboard is only, I mean, relatively speaking, is only, I think, $160. And the pen is $100, just like Apple Pencil. So, and it's unproven, in my opinion, since, you know, none of us has really had a chance to use it. It's $900 starting. So, really, I think it's cheaper to buy an iPad Pro with a better configuration. So I'm probably not going to buy it as much as I'm tempted to because I really like Chrome OS. And Frank, your thought? Are you going to pick one up? I know you buy a lot of stuff.
No, I am not going to buy this. I my first reaction, if you followed my blog,
yeah,
and on Twitter on this, is that this is dead on arrival.
Yeah, I saw your Twitter.
Now my first, I'm thinking first of all as a tablet. And I really reacted to the low end price of this. So basically, the one thing about the Slate is that it comes in four different models.
At least, maybe more. I think
there are four different models, starting with the lowest price at $599, which is an Intel Celeron,
right,
with 4 gig of RAM and 32 gig of storage.
Right.
There are actually two flavors of that. Then you step up to the one that I think is considered the competitor to the iPad Pro, which is an 8th Gen Intel Core M3, 8 gig of RAM and 64 gig of storage for $799. And then it kind of goes up from that.
Yeah.
So clearly, and it's a 12-inch tablet. So for me, you know, first of all, a 12-inch To call that a tablet, it's debatable. It's more of a two-in-one in my view. It's a device you use primarily in landscape for the majority of your time. And because you got the larger screen, you're going to want to use the keyboard.
Yeah.
And so, as you noted, $200, or if you get the bridge keyboard that goes with it, you can pay $159. But regardless, you're north of $1,000.
Yep.
Once you get the $799 one, I mean, I would not recommend anybody getting a 32 gig storage device.
Yeah.
So you're going to compete against the iPad Pro, given how far along iOS is, and you think you're going to be successful. I now, granted, Chrome OS, Android, and Linux apps on that device certainly gives it a much broader, you know, a much higher number of apps available than the previous gen Android tablets, but you know, iOS, the iPad 12 Pro has been out for well more than a year. I think more than 2 years. So it's a 12-inch model. And it's, you know, for somebody who's looking at a tablet of that large of a screen, I think you've probably already bought an iPad Pro. I can see people who like and really like Android, maybe some people who like Linux apps and see this as a tablet for them. Beyond that, I think it's hard. No matter how good the device looks, how they're going to get much in the way of sales.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, the problem Google has here with this is that, you know, the only successful tablet that Google really has sold was the Nexus 7, and we just talked earlier about the Nexus Prod, but the Nexus 7 had two things going for it. One was the fact that it was a 7-inch tablet at a time when 7-inch tablets weren't as prevalent. And it was so successful that it caused Steve Jobs to do something he said he wasn't going to do, which is to sell a smaller iPad, the iPad Mini. So it was that successful. And it was successful because of the 7-inch screen, but probably more so by the fact that it had essentially top of the line or premium features for a very affordable price.
$200.
That's what made it successful.
Yep.
And, you know, to deviate from that model and now go head to head at a premium price with premium products or somebody, a competitor that's got quite a bit of lead on you, I don't get it. I don't know how that succeeds.
Well, there is a market for the Chromebooks in general. And so this is obviously going to appeal only to the high-end, either the very rich user or the developer who wants to use it for some kind of development. And with running Linux apps in a container, now you can actually do some pretty serious development on it. But yeah, you're right. That was your thinking was pretty much parallel to mine. I think you reached your conclusion before I did. I remember following what you were thinking about writing about, and I hadn't quite made up my mind. And after thinking about it, I said, you know what? I already have a really good Google Chromebook that I use every single day, my Samsung Chromebook Plus. I kind of wanted a second one to play with the Linux containers, but I, quite frankly, I don't want to spend $1,000 for that privilege. So I'm probably, if I buy anything, I'm probably going to buy another MacBook of some kind, if it's reasonably priced.
If you are in the market,
yeah.
If you really do want a Chrome OS based tablet,
yeah.
at an affordable price,
yeah.
Then the model I would suggest really looking at is the HP Chromebook X2.
I just read about that.
Which is the 2-in-1.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find the price. You can buy it through Hewlett Packard right now or Best Buy. And I believe the price is around that $599, a little more north of $6. And it comes with the keyboard and the pen.
Yeah.
And of course, obviously, it's a 2-in-1, so you can use tablet. It's a Core i5. It's got all the specs that you could possibly want at a lower price.
Yeah, I see it for $600 in stock from HP.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if it's available on Amazon.
Last I knew, they were selling primarily either direct on HP or Best Buy.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really see it on Amazon. It's like available from these sellers, so yes, not from Amazon.
Well, my next device that I've so far I've managed to get through 2018 without actually spending buying a new piece of technical kit, but I have been looking at a new Chromebook because of the update for the Linux apps.
Yep.
It's probably time for me to get a more current keyboard-based device, so not a tablet, but actually something more like a notebook. And some of the newer Chromebooks that are coming out now that will support, non-Celeron-based processors around that $600 price tag are really appealing to me. So I will probably go that route this year.
Yeah, and the Samsung Chromebook Plus that is now about a year and a half old, or at least I've had it about a year and a half. It will run. It not only runs Android apps. In fact, it was the first Chromebook that came that supported Android apps out of the box, without installing the beta. It also supports the Project Crostini Linux containers. So, it's not like I can't do it. It's just that I kind of didn't want to take any performance hit if there was one, and I don't know that for sure. I'm just kind of guessing. If I turn containers on, I might take a hit on other areas, but that's just a guess. I might do it anyway. So John, you're not a Chromebook person, but
no, and I do think I definitely agree with Frank's point about Google should have kept where they were successful versus trying to go where they weren't. But and also that does scare me, Todd, that we probably will never see a refresh of the iPad Mini ever again.
Yeah,
because really, it was truly just the answer to the Pixel 7 or the Nexus 7 tablet. So
yeah, I'm really sad. I mean I still use my iPad Mini 4, which is the last one that was released, pretty close to every day, if not actually every day. If nothing else, I pull it out on work days for reading news during lunch. It's tethered, of course. It doesn't have LTE, but or at least I shouldn't say of course, mine doesn't have LTE. Alrighty, so the next thing up, I know that Frank's interested in. I'm kind of curious to see if John's interested in it. I don't think so, but it's the Google Home Hub. It's a 7-inch display Google Assistant device, and at first I just kind of ignored it, even during the announcement, because I already have the Lenovo Smart Display. But then I read in Ars Technica that they're actually completely different bases, so all the smart displays, well, all three, I guess, Lenovo, LG, and Samsung, and JBL, I guess, so the four, they all run on Android Things, which is a new kind of IoT-based Android. But the Google Home Hub is actually based on Google Cast, so it's more closely related to Chromecast than anything else. Although apparently, functionally, it's the same. So, and like Frank said earlier in the podcast, it's only $150. I think I paid $230 for mine, which is a couple bucks off its $250 list, and it included a free Google Home Mini. So now I have two Google Home Minis I don't use. But so, Frank, is this something you're going to buy?
Well, I'm not running out to go get one right now. Maybe I will end up doing like I did with the Google Home, and you know, around Christmas time or something, if there's some sales.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll grab one. I'm a little disappointed that it doesn't have the actual smart home hub features like I think the Alexa Hub. You know, right now I utilize I have Hue lights, I have Samsung Smart Things, and I have separate hubs for both of those.
Yeah.
And that's you know, something I tolerate because I'm a tech person. But the average person, you know, you don't want to mess with so many hubs, and that is definitely a problem. And so a device like this, the Home Hub, that literally talked the different protocols that support those different Internet of Things devices would be appealing. The Home Hub does, the new device from Google interacts with like Hue lights, but I suspect it requires that you still have the Hue Hub on your network, which, you know, then you're basically
talking to
the
it.
Google Home is talking to it, and then, you know, it's a bridge. So that doesn't get past that problem, and that's kind of disappointing.
Yeah, and for me, I'm not going to get it simply, even though it's different and I'm curious about it now. I already have a smart display, like I mentioned, so which I like a lot, by the way. I'm really kind of surprised how much I use it.
Where do you have it?
Huh?
Where do you keep it?
I keep it
in the kitchen?
Or? Yeah, I have it in the dining room.
Okay.
And so anytime, you know, we're talking and you have a question, we just ask it stuff and it shows it to us. It's amazing. You know,
okay.
Like morning traffic, weather. Well, weather is bad because weather is always off here. The Echo's weather source is much better than Google's for some reason. But it's, or even just news, you know, because you can play, you know, YouTube on it. So it's really kind of handy. And the news sources these days are pretty good about updating the news on YouTube. So it's pretty timely. And it is a 10-inch device, which helps. I think it's 10 or 10.1.
Well, the touchscreen is 7, the Home Hub.
Yeah.
The touchscreen is actually 7. Now, there is a good-sized bezel, so the physical size is obviously...
Oh, I meant the Lenovo, sorry.
Oh.
The Lenovo I use is a 10-inch. So, you know, that's the other thing, right? 7 inches is fine for, like, Nexus 7. But when it's something you might want somebody else to look at, like, hey, look at this map, you know, or whatever... the 10-inch is really nice. So that's the only other thing, but I don't have one. So, you know, I guess I could prop up an iPad mini and see how it looks like in a multi-user environment, so to speak, where you're kind of suggesting somebody look at something with you. Cool. Hey, I think John has to disappear.
Oh, yep, I do. But I think Google is definitely, you know, as my kind of closing thoughts, like Google is definitely making strides in good directions here and there, but I think they do need to really think about who is buying these products, and if you're going to price them at this level, then you have to make a really compelling argument to away from the Apple ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, their Pixel 3 and Pixel Slate prices are, you know, equal to or more than an equivalent Apple device, which is saying something, because Apple, you know, nobody ever calls Apple stuff inexpensive. That's for sure.
No, but if, you know, you've basically made the narrative over the last 10 years, Android is inexpensive and almost just as good.
Right.
And in many cases, if you tune an Android device, it is just as good. But,
yeah.
You know, the earlier devices did have a lot of issues with quality of, you know, speed and everything else.
Right.
Now you've got to kind of shake that image off if you're going to go premium. And I don't think you've shaken off the you know, sort of branding of it's a bargain device and it will be less powerful, because then people will go, well, if you're going to price it the same way, I'll go with the more powerful and reliable iPhone.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you're going to buy a, if they have the choice between a Volkswagen Beetle and a high-end Mercedes and they're the same price, there's not a lot of reason to
even
go
if the Beetle, you know, is, you know, just as capable. That's the weird thing, you know. The it's going to be the stereotypes that are going to get them.
I think if they came out with the 8 gig 64 gig storage model, the Core AM, and they priced it at $600, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah, I think
so. A $600 tablet at that size with that amount of processing is now a compelling device.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to undercut the iPad Pro 12. But since you choose to price it at literally the same thing, now you're forcing the comparison, and it then quickly goes out of the almost no-brainer category to a head-to-head decision, and it's tough to win that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, John's dropping off, I think.
Yep, I will talk to you guys both later.
Okay.
And Frank, thanks for joining. Todd, see you next week.
All righty. The last couple of things, Frank, which I guess doesn't really affect you, the Pixel Stand, which is a wireless charger. It doesn't affect us because our Pixel 2 doesn't wirelessly charge, as I recall. They dropped, I think, the Pixel, original Pixel, or maybe not the original Pixel. I knew the Nexus could do a Qi charging or key charging, but... the Pixels do not until now. So they've only restored that feature now. And then a new Chromecast, I think, but not a huge fan.
There's a new model of Chromecast. It's actually was kind of not even formally announced at the event. They just kind of slipped it in as kind of an update or refresh.
Right.
I think it's got a support for a higher frame rate, so a little bit better video output performance, perhaps some software tweaks. But essentially, I don't think it has a huge amount of change from the prior generation, which is probably why they didn't spend any real time talking about it.
Yeah.
Okay. The Pixel Stand is $79, and they did add some software updates to make that act a little bit like a smart display, not exactly the same, but basically when you put your Pixel phone in the stand, then it changes to a always-on display that can display information and, you know, changes with the ambient lighting and all that type of stuff. So it's that's why it is a stand as opposed to just a flat slab where you just, you know, put it on like a table counter or whatever. It actually stands up the phone. So that's its unique. Obviously, if you want, I have a Qi charger, one of the others that already, you know, already have that should work. So this would be for somebody who's specifically looking for a stand.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I bought on Amazon Prime Day in July, I bought a 8-inch Fire HD, or a Fire HD 8, I guess, a tablet, because it was $50. And one of its features was to become a kind of like a very cheap Amazon show, where, you know, it would go into kind of a assistant mode. You don't really need a stand to do that, it turns out. You can just turn it on. But it's funny. So the Fire HD 8 is $50, and the stand is like $80, I think. But it turns out all you really need is, you know, to plop it somewhere that's kind of standing up so you can see it and plug it in and turn on the assistant mode or whatever it's called. And it was interesting, but because it didn't have an array microphone like the various Echoes do and the Lenovo Smart Display does, it didn't hear me very well. And so it wasn't as useful as it might. Anyway, anything else?
I think we pretty much hashed through the announcements. I would assume the Pixels will continue to sell at the rate, whatever rate that's been for the Pixel phones. It will be interesting to see how well the Slate does. I think a good sign as any is to see when the price drops start to begin.
Yeah.
And see where that stands.
Like you said, I think if the M3 model, which is kind of the I guess a second tier up from the Celeron. If that thing drops to, say, 500, I would consider it. You know, and if the keyboard drops to 150 so that the total package is 650 without a pen, I think I'd consider it. I should also note that the Samsung Chromebook Plus comes with a pen, a stylus. It's not an active stylus like, you know, the Apple Pencil or the whatever the heck they're calling the I guess, a slate pen. But it's pretty decent. I can...
Well, the only other problem I have there, and as you know, I'm a pretty dedicated stylus user. Mm-hmm. I use the Apple Pencil a lot. Is what's the app support for it? Because, you know,
question.
Now on my iPad Pro 10.5, which is my one of my main productivity machines that I use the Apple Pencil with, you know, I can use that with OneNote is my primary use case, but there's a whole host of applications that I can use that with. Whereas, yeah, you know, I'm not sure that the pen and ink support on Chrome OS and Android is quite as pervasive. So that's another issue. If you're really a heavy digital ink user, you know, the finding an app, say, beyond Google Keep or what Google provides.
Yeah,
certainly Evernote, it's not going to support it. So
yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because on the Chromebook Plus I have, which, you know, like I said, has a stylus, Samsung, the manufacturer of the hardware, actually provides a little drawing tool that works quite well with the pen, actually. Not great like the Pencil on the iPad Pro, but, you know, well enough for a passive device. And I think that's the only thing I've ever used with a stylus on it. I don't think I know of anything else. So, yeah, your point is well taken. I'd have to get some kind of note-taking tool, or, you know, with handwriting recognition or a doodling, you know, an art app or something that I'd find interesting before the pen would become worthwhile at $100 extra. But certainly $700, let's call it $600. $100 for the keyboard and $500 for the device. $600, that's a buy if I could find an M3. You know, with some decent amount. Oh, also, I think it doesn't have an SD slot. The Slate does not have an SD slot.
I think you're right. I don't see it on the
slot. Yeah, side. So the Chromebook Plus I have, which I think has 32 gigs of storage. You know, I popped in a 64 gigabyte SD slot, SD card in a slot, and it's, you know, I can store, you know, whatever it is I need to store under documents or whatever.
Right.
So
now, if you, I mean, the good thing it does have is it does have two USB-C ports.
That's true.
On it. So that provides you with a little more flexibility for accessories.
Yeah.
You know, everything from larger external displays. And it is a, you know, Chrome OS is a desktop-ish operating system. It can support dual monitors. You can basically make this Slate act like a desktop computer properly configured. The other interesting thing we hadn't touched about, it does have a 293 pixels per inch display, something they call a molecular display.
It's
which
like
is,
their,
I don't know, a bit of marketing or whatever. But
it's their branding, like Retina on the iPad.
Yeah.
And also I think it's a 3:2 display ratio. So it's not the 16:9 we see on notebooks or, you know, whatever. So it's kind of a more traditional, and by more traditional, I mean the before widescreen displays are popular, you know, most of our displays are 3:2, I think. So more square than rectangular. And quite frankly, I liked it because it was easier to read Word documents and spreadsheets with a little bit taller screen. And in fact, at work, I have two monitors attached to my Surface Pro 4, and one is I think it's a 22 or 24 inch monitor, and I have it in portrait mode, and it is perfect for reading long PDF documents or editing Word files or writing Word files. It's great to see a full page at 100% size, or even larger. So I would not mind that. Okay, Frank. Well, thanks as usual for taking time to join us. And we're going to ask you back next month as we celebrate yet another Mobile Views podcast anniversary.
All right.
Yeah, we've been doing this a long time and a lot of it with you since the beginning. All righty. So, folks, this has been Mobile Views podcast 272. all we talk about is Google stuff, really. We didn't touch on the various and sundry other things, like Windows Update keeps messing up for Windows 10 users. I think the latest is it now loses sound for some people after you update it. So don't update yet, I guess, until you get the all clear from the pioneers. Alrighty, so John dropped off. Thank you to Frank McPherson. This is Todd Ogasawara, and we will talk to you next time.